Hi, everybody. My name is Juanita Yule, and I'm a very grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups. It's really nice to be here. Really, really nice. I've had a good time. Cedar Rapids is absolutely gorgeous. The lilac bushes are unbelievable. My husband and I, whenever we travel, he's always the one who says, "Oh, I could live here." And I keep my mouth shut. And I haven't told him yet, but I think I could live here. And unfortunately, I've said it on tape, so he just may play it back for me. I may be in trouble. I really have had a good time already. Mike picked us up from the airport yesterday, and we just had a good time. And Erica, I feel at home here. I got to tell you, I really feel at home, because there's a lot of people here I know. Mike and Erica, I've known for a long time. And there's a conference we go to up in Colorado that I've been seeing them for years. Vinoy, I've met Vinoy, and I've seen Vinoy from time to time. And it's just very cool. There's some people from here who've also been to the Fellowship of the Spirit conference in Colorado. And then Peggy. I've had the opportunity to get to know Peggy. Oh, thank you. From the World Service Conference. We just got back from that Sunday. Was it Sunday? And I was telling Peggy that I have had to come to Iowa to rest up from it. I really have. It's like we had 3 days at home, and then we left and came here. And I've been sleeping every afternoon. I've been taking great naps, so I'm real happy with Iowa. And it really was great to go to that Al-Anon meeting last night. You know, I feel like I've already gotten the blessing. I don't know what message you all are going to get from my talk, but I know that whenever I get an opportunity to tell my story, I'm the one who always gets, I feel, the bigger part of it. And I feel like I got that already last night talking to this newcomer who came to the meeting. You could just see her, the tension in her as she walked in the room. And you could just feel her anxiety. And by the end of the meeting, you could just see that a little of that had gone. And for me, that's one of my favorite things, is talking to a newcomer. And it seems to just work that way, that if ever there's a problem, to get out of myself is always a blessing. I remember a couple of years ago, I was exceptionally busy, and it just seemed like I had no time to myself. So I remember sitting down one morning after prayer and meditation and saying, "Okay, God, I really need a break here, okay? And can I just have a few days to myself, like with no sponsees calling, no service commitments, just, you know, and not have to like worry or think about anybody and just have some quiet?" Well, I don't know about your God, but my God usually always gives me what I want. And he did. I found myself with about a week of free time. My husband Tom had gone away, I think, to visit his mother. My youngest daughter, who's the only one who was still living with us at that time, had gone away on some trip. And so it was just me at home. Not only was it just me at home, but all the sponsees, I had canceled the meetings that I had set up with them. And all of a sudden, I found myself getting home from work, and it was quiet. And after 2 days of this, I didn't know what the heck to do with myself. I found myself in self-pity, I found myself in resentment, I found myself wanting to, you know, that's what happens to me when I have too much time to think about me. It's not a pretty picture. I am not a pretty picture. I love that thing in the big book that says the alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Hello, you know, me and my cups, and my cups for me is that I get full of resentment, I get full of self-pity, and all I think about is me, poor me, poor me, and poor me when nobody's there. You know, it's like, what is this? But that's me when I have just a little bit too much time. So, my story. I was born in a little town that probably, you know, way back then had about 3,000 people. And one of my very first memories is waking up at my grandmother's home. And my grandmother had one of these little old adobe casitas. And it's an adobe home, for those of you who don't know, is made out of mud bricks. And they're stacked about the way you'd stack up bricks, but Grandma also had no running water. She had dirt floors. She had no heating except for her wood stove. And to use a bathroom, you had to go out to the outhouse, and you had to go out to the well and draw the water. So she would come in the morning, and she'd say, "Come on, Jita," which basically means daughter, little daughter. And we'd walk out to the well, and we'd pull the bucket off the hook, and we'd lower the bucket into the well. And I would always be in suspense, and I'd always be waiting, you know. And what was I waiting for? Well, I was waiting for the bucket to come up so I could take a look in it. Because in the bucket, there'd always be a surprise. Sometimes there'd be a little water spider, a little bug. And the best for me was when there'd be one of those little teeny tiny baby frogs, you know. And it was always so cool. You know, I have grandkids, and I can't imagine my grandkids coming to Grandma's house and, like, drinking the water. You know, they'd be like, "Oh, gross, Grandma." You know, but the first drink from that water, from that bucket, was just the sweetest tasting water you could ever have in your life. And those were the days for me that were days of freedom and days when I was just open to what the day had to bring, and what was the next surprise, what was in store for me. And little by little, what living with alcoholism did to me was that it whittled that away, to the degree that by the time I met Tom, I was like 23. By the time I was 21, I'd already been married, I'd been divorced, and I had a daughter. And that first husband of mine, you know, I was 17 when I got married and when I had my daughter. And there's something that happens to you when you get married that young. You can't be responsible, you know. I thought I was ready to be a wife, and I thought I was ready to be a mother, and I couldn't do it. I expected my husband to be responsible, to just be an adult, and it doesn't work that way. And he couldn't. And in fact, after a few months, what I realized about him was that he had this slight allergy. And his allergy was to work. He'd just, you know, he'd go for a few days and then quit, and go for a few days and quit. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong with him, so finally it was just like, I just got to get out of this. And I did. I was able to get out of this. By the time I met Tom, and we'd been together for a little bit, I could no longer get out of it. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about the progression of the family disease of alcoholism, because I got to see it progress in my life. What happened for me was that about 2 months after I'd met Tom, I walked into the bathroom, and he loves to take baths. And so I saw he was in the bathroom, and he'd fallen asleep. He worked so hard, don't you know? He's a construction worker, and he worked outside in the cold or whatever, and he worked very hard. And so when he took a bath and I walked in, I saw him fast asleep, and I thought, poor guy, he just works so hard. This one worked, the other one didn't, so this one was still a keeper. So I went in and I went into the bathroom, and I let the water out a little bit, and I filled it back up with some hot water, not too hot, and it wasn't too high, it was just right, you know, I still wanted to keep him around. And I left, and sometime in the night he came to bed, and, you know, life went on. Well, in the next few years, we ended up having a daughter. He had come into the relationship with two boys. They were 5 and 7, and I had my daughter who was 6. Now, these kids were all blonde and, like, light-eyed, green eyes, you know, and they looked like they were brothers and sisters. And they just fell in together. They became really tight, and they were good friends. And I really think it was because it had to be them against us. You know, I mean, we used to drag him around all the place, every place we went, and it was not fun. When we got married, our kids called it the wedding from hell. It was, oh gosh, I can't. My parents cringed at it, you know, and his mother. I mean, it was just terrible. terrible. I don't even want to think about it. Anyway, it's enough to suffices enough to say our kids said it was the wedding from hell, and they were teeny, and I think they had more sense than we did. I know they had more sense than we did. So anyway, we ended up having this little girl, this baby, yours, mine, and ours. We finally had ours, and I remember being in the hospital and not wanting to leave. You know, it's like I was being taken care of there in the hospital, and I didn't have to be responsible. And a year and a half into our living together, because we started living together almost immediately, I think within a month of our meeting each other, we started living together. So a year and a half later, we're married and we're having a little girl, and I'm in the hospital, and I just don't even want to go home. And he says things to me like, I'm leaving now, and he's just been there 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and he says, but I'll be back later tonight. And I'd say, okay. And then tonight would come, and he wouldn't come. And the next morning when he'd call, he said, oh, well, I got really busy, and I couldn't come. He says, but I'll be there in a little while. And like 2 hours later, he'd show up at the hospital, and he said, well, you know, I had to go check on some things, and, you know, but I'm here. And, you know, and he'd stay for 5-10 minutes and then leave. And I just thought, oh, man, what's it going to be like when I get out of here? It's like one more kid to take care of. And my mother had raised my daughter, the first one. You know, when you're that young, and I'd already started a thing with my first husband, that I had to be there with him. Even though I wasn't happy in the relationship, I had to do whatever he did and be with him with whatever he was going to do. And so my mother raised that little girl. But when it came to this second one, I knew my mom wasn't going to raise this one. I can't even tell you how I knew. I just knew it wasn't going to happen. And what happened to me with Tom when we first met was that everything he did, I did. I believe that within 20 minutes of meeting him, he said to me, honey, I'm an alcoholic. I like to do drugs, and I especially like a little heroin every now and then. And my first thought was, well, this will be interesting. And it was. So you can see how I'm sitting in the hospital and I don't want to come home because I'm not sure what it's going to be like at home, except that it's already hasn't been very good in the last year and a half. So finally he comes for me that last day and he's 2 hours late, and he'd always say to me, just wait because I'll be there. And if I'm not there, just wait because I'll be here. And I started this habit of waiting. It's like not living my life, just waiting and waiting and waiting. And within the next year, actually not even the next year, within 6 months of this little tiny one being born, we had violence enter our home. Now, I know some of you are going to relate to this and some of you might not, but whenever we had this fight, and he would like draw his hands back. He hadn't hit me, you know, but he'd like make as if he was, or I'd feel as if though he was. I'd always get this look in my face and in my eyes like, go ahead, I dare you, you know? And like I was tough inside, because I didn't feel tough inside, but I had to act like I was tough inside. And this one night, this look came over him as I said, go ahead, I dare you. And this look that crossed his eyes, I just had, it entered into me, and I thought, this man could really hurt me. And for the briefest of seconds, I had fear, you know? And I could just see it in my face, you know, I could just feel it. And it wasn't long, but it was long enough that all of a sudden, he like went for me. And that little daughter who my mother had raised was with us that night. And it's a good thing she was, because she had to call the police. And he was taken to jail. Well, the next day, I came home at noon, because I went to work, you know, and I went to work as if nothing had happened. And I would just look at the people at work with my face black and blue, daring them to say something. You know, like, there's nothing wrong here. I don't know what y'all are looking at, you know, but there's nothing wrong with this picture. And when I went home at noon, and he was there, he said, I can't believe what happened. He said, I love you so much. He says, I can't imagine hurting you. He says, I don't even remember doing this to you. He said, and I was like, you don't remember? How can you not remember? And he said, I really don't. He says, the first thing I remember is coming to in the police car and then taking me away and then telling me what I'd done and that my daughter had to call them to get me off of you. He says, I don't remember doing it. And I knew that was true. Somewhere deep within me, I knew that that was true. I knew that it wasn't something he wanted to do. And I knew he loved me. And it never happened again, but, you know, it was... Those are the kinds of things that started to happen in our home. So, you know, shortly thereafter, about two years after that had happened, I walk into the bathroom again, and I see him laying in the tub. And this time I know he's not asleep. This time I know he's passed out. And every bit of anger and every bit of frustration that has started to grow in me, I just looked at him and I just thought, oh, if I could get an ice truck and get this truck to come and dump its load into this tub, I would do it. I mean, just because my role at that point had become to make him miserable. If I was miserable, I was going to make him more miserable than I was. It never once occurred to me that perhaps he already was. Never once. It was all about me. Everything was about me. He didn't enter into the picture except how I could make him miserable. So we kept on a little bit longer. You know, it's amazing how we live with some of this stuff and how long we live with it. And it got to the point where my prayer was, God, take this guy's life. We used to have to travel about 16 miles from where we lived to where we worked. And there was this place where about 6-7 years before I had lost an uncle in a drunken car wreck. And I knew Tom had to pass this way, and I knew he'd been drinking. I mean, that was a given. And I said, I know the spot, God. This spot works, you know? And my prayer was that he would go over, and every night he'd show up. And then we'd have the middle of winter, and snow would be coming down, and he would get out of his truck and try to make it in to the house, and he just would like stumble or just pass out or something, and he'd be lying in 6 inches of snow, and the snow would still be coming down, and I'd look out the window and I'd think, okay, and I'd shut the door or shut the curtains, and I think, by morning I'll be a widow. That's the way my life was, you know. It had become, how can I get rid of him? It sounds crazy when I say it today, but back then, it was the only thing I could think of. Not too long ago, about 2 years ago, Tom said, why didn't you just leave me? And I said, if I could have, I would have. It's like, why didn't you just quit drinking? That's the way it was for me, you know? I mean, if he could have quit drinking, he would have, right? If I could have left him, I would have. We'd gotten to the point where he said, honey, I see how miserable I'm making you. I see how miserable I'm making the kids. I'll just leave. And I'd say, you can't. You can't go. He'd become my whole entire life. Everything revolved around him. It wasn't even my children. I used to say, my children are the most important thing to me. I would do anything for my children. Well, if that were the truth, I wouldn't have stayed in the relationship. It was a lie. I didn't know what was true, and I didn't know what was false. I had no clue. I had no clue what was real anymore. So I walk into the bathroom one more time. It's probably about a year and a half or so before he came into the program and I did. And I look at him passed out in the tub, and I think, who in the world would know if I were to shove this drunk's head under? I'm sure a few, one or two, have died that way, you know. They just kind of slinked into the tub. And I can still see my hand reaching, you know, to do this. And I had two thoughts at that point. And the two thoughts were, first, remember that old TV show Columbo? Columbo came into my mind. Columbo always got his man or woman, and I just knew that there was going to be some little old policeman in Santa Fe who was like this little Columbo, and he'd figure out it was me. And then the very next thought that came into my mind, and what'll happen to your kids? What'll happen to your kids when they don't have a father and their mother's in the state penitentiary? And that was God. That was God acting in my life. a God that I didn't trust in, a God I didn't believe in, a God I wanted no part of, because I didn't like this God. He had screwed up my life. God had given me this life of despair, a life where I couldn't wait to go to bed at night and have the day done, a life when I woke up in the morning, I didn't want to be there, I didn't want to live. And it wasn't that I ever thought of suicide, but it was like, just let me kind of go poof, you know, like just let me disappear out into the ozone and not even be around, because I'm not important, I'm not doing good here, I'm not a good parent, I'm not a good wife. If I were a good wife, he would be sober, he wouldn't be going through this stuff he was going through. And I couldn't understand why he was still drinking. You see, because I had done everything he did. I kept up with him. And if I kept up with him and I could stop, why couldn't he? I just couldn't figure it out. So finally we had a talk one day. You know, I'd woken up after having this dream, and in this dream, there's this guy coming out of the gutter, crawling out of this gutter, and as he's crawling out, the gutter's getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And as he's coming towards me, I look at him and I go, oh my God, this is who you're married to. This is your life. And if this is who you're married to, this guy who's disheveled and dirty, you know, and wild looking, what does that say about you? What does it say about your life? And I couldn't dismiss it anymore. And so when I woke up that morning, I thought, oh God, this can't be real. Because everything in my life had become about, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. It couldn't be that bad, because it was too painful. It had to be better than what I thought it was. And my life was about such denial that I remember one point, I was cleaning out his Levi jacket, and as I pulled into the pockets and to take out the Kleenex and stuff to wash it, and I pulled out his syringe and his spoon and stuff, and I sat down on the bed holding him in my hands, and he walked into the bathroom at that point, and I said, what is this? What is this? And he patted me on the shoulder, and he said, honey, it's not what you think. And I said, oh, okay. Because it couldn't be what I thought. What I thought was too bad. You know? What I thought was too bad. I had thoughts about reading his obituary and how embarrassed I would be. If he had died of alcoholism, I could live with that. I couldn't live with the fact that perhaps his obituary would say something about he died from an overdose. I couldn't live with that. That I couldn't handle. So anyway, we ended up having a little discussion that morning. And I said a prayer, and I said, God, I've talked to him countless times. I can't even count the number of times I've spoken to this man. I said everything I can possibly say. I've got nothing new left. And I said, you're going to have to give me the words. If I talk to him, you're going to have to give me the words. And so we sat down and talked. I didn't know then that he was done with his stuff, too. Within 2 weeks, he went into a treatment center. And when I took him into the treatment center, they said, well, honey, they said, in order for him to leave here, because he's going to be here about 30 days, what you're going to have to do in order for to get him out is you're going to have to go to at least 3 or 4 Al-Anon meetings while he's here before you can take him home. And I thought, you can just keep him if you want him that bad. You know? It was like, maybe this is now the answer, you know? It's like, I won't go, and they'll keep him, you know? But the interesting thing when I took him in that day was that they had him fill out this sheet of paper disclosing how much he drank and the drugs he took and the frequency of it. And I sat down and helped him fill it out. And I mean, I probably remember more than he did. I mean, he was drunk all the time. It's like, so he probably needed a little help. And he turned that in. And shortly thereafter, they came into the room and they handed me the same thing. And they said, honey, this one's for you to fill out. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, it's just to get to know you better. And I said, oh, okay. And so I started filling it out, you know, and it said, do you drink? And well, yeah, you know, socially every once in a while, and rarely anymore. I mean, you know, somebody had to change their lifestyle. He wouldn't, I did. And they said, pot? And I said, well, you know, once or twice, rarely. Checked that off. And they went on to cocaine and painkillers, heroin, and I didn't check anything off there. And I said, well, I guess I'm ready to hand it in. And Tom said, what about these three? And I said, well, what about them? And he goes, well, you did those? And I said, yeah, but hardly ever, you know, hardly ever. And I turned in my form, because I always had a reason for it, you know, I turned in my form. And when I left there, I'll tell you, I left that treatment center, and I knew he was in there for about 30 days. And I just felt such incredible pain, because I felt like a mother abandoning her child, because that's what our relationship had gotten to. I was the mother, and he was the child, and I felt like I was leaving my two-year-old kid there. And then the other thing I felt was, having filled out that form, I thought, what happened to the little Catholic girl going to Catholic school, singing that song, God is love, love is God, and feeling it deep in my heart, you know, and just like feeling the presence of God, you know, at a young age, 7 or 8, what happened to that child? And I thought, it was all about, I didn't think it then, looking back, I think it, you know, it was all about doing anything I could to be with the alcoholic. I would do anything to be with him, anything. It didn't matter what he was doing, it didn't matter where he went, I was right there with him, and it was all to be with him. But for the grace of God, I hadn't found it necessary, and haven't found it necessary to join any other program but the Al-Anon family groups. You know, and it's amazing because of what I did. But I'll tell you, well, I'll get into that a little bit further, I imagine. But what happened to us when he was in the treatment center, I had no intention of going to Al-Anon. But he started calling me and he'd say, have you gone to Al-Anon? You know, they suggested you went. And I thought, well, yeah, he's just trying to make me go so that he can come home, you know. And he kept after me and kept after me. And I think he was in there about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, when finally I said, okay, I'll go to this thing, you know. And the first time I went, I went and I saw where they were going into. And they were going downstairs into this basement. And it looked dark and it looked really dreary. And the people didn't look too swift who were going in there. They didn't look like they were hip, slick, and cool, you know. And I thought, well, I'll just drive around the block. And by the time I'd driven around the block, I'd talked myself out of going. And so when he called me, he said, well, did you go? And I said, no. And he says, well, you should go. And he'd found this little AA meeting at the treatment center. And he loved it. And he says, you're going to really like it. They're really nice. And I really like the AA meeting. And I said, yeah, well, good for you. As far as I was concerned, he was in a resort, you know. I mean, he wasn't the one stuck at home with the kids, paying the bills and going to work, you know. And he'd say, well, I was out playing basketball with the guys. And I'm like, oh, yeah, cool, you know. And but he kept after me. He says, you know, go, go, go. And I'd gone to a family day, and I thought I was starting to learn some stuff about alcoholism and the family disease of alcoholism. And so when I finally went, I went to this meeting, and I just knew that the people there had nothing to offer me. They were housewives. I was not a housewife. They were old hippies. We had a lot of old hippies still doing Santa Fe and been there, done that. They were certainly not going to give me anything of value. And then there were people who were dressed quite nicely. They looked like they worked in an office. And I thought, they have nothing to offer me either. Because I had worked in an office for years. And I knew their lives were not like mine. I didn't hear them talk about the things at work that were going on in my home. The one time I had mentioned to someone that Tom and I had come over the border, you know, from Mexico into New Mexico, and that they stopped us and they searched the car and that I was strip searched, their eyes went this big. And I thought, can't talk about that at work, you know? And they can't relate. So I just knew that they didn't know my life. And there was a woman there at that meeting, and she started talking about how she didn't know what to do with her alcoholic husband. He was drinking, and she tried everything, and he just wouldn't go to treatment. She didn't know what to do. And so she finished her sharing, and it was her first meeting. This was my first meeting, but I'd been to a family weekend, you know, and I'd gotten a little bit of literature there. And so she said thank you, and I raised my hand, and they said, go ahead. And I said, well, my name's Juanita, and I said, this is what I did to get my husband into treatment. And I had forgotten that quickly, within 3 or 4 weeks, that when I said that prayer that morning, it was a God I was turning to, and it wasn't my words. It was God I'd asked for the words. And I thought, once again, I had power. Because I always thought I had power. I'd try and figure it out and figure out just how to do it. And so I took back everything, and I thought, I got him into treatment. It wasn't that he was ready. It had nothing to do with God, heaven forbid, you know. It was all about me and how I got him in. And so when I finished sharing, I said, thank you. They said, thank you very much. Please keep coming back. And I thought, I will, because these people valued what I had to share. They needed me. You know? I had something of value to give them about this alcoholism thing. And so I kept going for the wrong reasons. And then after I brought Tom home from the treatment center, I remember we were on our way home, and I thought, who is this man? Who is this man? I had no clue who he was. The only way I knew how to relate to him was with him drinking. You know, I didn't know what to do with this guy who was clean and sober. I had no idea who he was, and I was scared. I was so scared. I thought, he's going to spend a week with me if it takes that long, and he's going to realize I'm not smart enough, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not thin enough, I'm not sexy enough, I'm not rich enough. All the enoughs he's going to know I don't have. And he's going to say, see you later, I'm out of here. And so I thought, I'm going to get this thing, I'm going to start picking up what they talk about. And I also heard a conversation between Tom and this other guy who was in AA. And they were talking about this guy who left his wife. And what they said was, well, so-and-so left because she was really crazy. She wouldn't go to Al-Anon, and his sobriety was more important than being with her. And I thought, I will be darned if I'm going to have that happen to me. My whole life before he got sober was about how to get rid of him, how to kill him, how to, you know, end the thing. And I'm like, okay, we're, you know, stick it in. And, you know, now it's like time to dig your heels in and get better. But not get better, just pick up the language. Just pick up the language so that it would seem like I was getting it, so that he would think I was picking it up, so that we could stay together, so that he wouldn't leave me. Because he was still my whole life. Everything about him, or everything about my life, was still about him and how to keep him. He was still everything. So somehow, I think we get better just going to meetings. And I was in the program about a year when my youngest brother, he was 5 years younger than me, he was 28 at this point, he'd been ill for a long, long time. In fact, his whole life he'd been ill. He had, you know, different things wrong with him. But the last 4 or 5 years of his life, his kidneys, they took him into the hospital at one point, and they discovered his kidneys were working at 13%. So he had to start doing dialysis 3 times a week. And the last year of his life, he also developed diabetes. Well, the last couple of days, last 3 days of his life, he came into my mom's house, and he says, I'm not feeling well. And she says, well, should we take you to the emergency room? And he says, yeah, we better. And he'd already gotten to the point where he couldn't even hardly walk. You know, that Christmas, coming over to our home, Tom and my dad and my mother all had to help him up 3 steps into our home because he could hardly walk. And my brother had been affected by the family disease as well, you know. My dad used to drink, and I used to say when I first came into the program that he was an alcoholic. Truth is, I don't know if he was or not. When Tom got sober, my dad quit drinking. My dad says you just need willpower, you know. I guess it works for him, you know, he's still sober. But his drinking affected me, and his drinking affected my brother. My brother, at the age of 12, started attempting suicide. He tried it several times. Well, little by little, he got to the point where he was literally, his body was dying, you know. And so my mom ends up taking him into the emergency room. The minute he walks in, he falls into a coma. And my mom, I was with my mom there the whole last 3 days. And on the last night, my mom and I were going to walk into his room, and the doctors are reviving him for probably at least the 20th time. You know, they've got those electric things, put him on him. And it's at least the 20th time that they're using him on him. And I turned to my mom and put my arm around her, and I said, "Let's go for a walk, Mom." And we started walking around the floor of the intensive care unit, the cardiac unit. And I said, "How you doing?" And she said, "You know, I'm not doing so good." And I said, "Huh." I said, "Why? What's going on?" And she said, "Well," she says, "I'm afraid of where your brother's going to end up. You see, my mother had the same kind of God that I did before I came to you. A God that was going to punish you for the things you did. A God that's going to send you to hell for, you know, for what you did or what you didn't do." And we walked a little bit, and I said, "Yeah." I said, "You know, I said, I think God loves us. And I think God loves us so much that he knows what we're going to do before we do it. And because he loves us so much, he forgives us long before we do what we do. And he really doesn't care." Now, I had just enough from you all about God to be able to say that to her. And as we walked a little bit further and we got close to her room, I said, "Do you really believe that about God?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I really do." And the miracle for me was that it was in saying those words that I started to believe. And I thought, "Yeah, I really do." And it wasn't until I said it that I thought, "I do." And so as we got close to my brother's room, my mom finally said, "If God wants him that bad, God can have him." And just then the doctor comes out of my brother's room, and he said, "I'm really sorry. We did all we could." And Mom and I said, "Yeah, we know, and we appreciate it, and we thank you." And, you know, my God is so good that he waited until my mother was ready. He waited until she was ready and she could say, "God can now have him," so that she could be at peace about her son. That's my God. Very loving, very caring. And if it wasn't for that, it's like my brother's death. Everything that has happened to me in this program that I think is the worst thing that could happen to me, there's always a blessing. Living with an active alcoholic, I thought that's the worst thing that could happen, but it led me to you. You know, my brother's dying, you know, gave me the ability to find a God that I could see as a loving, caring God. Now, you think that that would just, like, settle me in and embrace the program, but no. It took another year for me to get to the point where I was ready, willing, and able to open up myself and ask somebody to be my sponsor. And what ended up happening to me was, after 2 years of sobriety in our home, Tom was in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh my God, he just loved it. He was on a pink cloud. You know, he'd go to meetings. He loved the fellowship. He loved it all. And I was not okay. And I thought, what is wrong? It's everything I've hoped for. It's everything I wanted. I'd always said if he just got sober, clean and sober, I would be all right, and I'm not. And it took 2 years of sitting in these meetings, sponsoring people and not knowing how to sponsor people. You know, I took these steps and I read them off the wall and I worked them off the wall. And you know what happens when you work these steps off the wall? You have an off-the-wall program. I had an off-the-wall program. I was off the wall. My behavior was off the wall. People would ask me to sponsor them, and I'd say yes, because I was sounding terrific in meetings. I picked up the lingo. It's what I wanted. But I wasn't helping anybody. I was causing harm. You know, I was causing harm. I made amends to my children, and in making amends to them, I told them things that they had no knowledge of. I had to go back later when I really started working the steps with a sponsor and make amends. So I'm desperate. My sponsor calls it the gift of desperation. 2 years in this program, I'm miserable. I don't like myself. In fact, I like myself less with 2 years in the program than I liked myself before coming to you. So it was a complete surprise to me one day, after having written some inventory, you know, it says we write inventory, I'd made an inventory, and I asked this woman, what I was going to ask her was, would you listen to my fifth step? And what ended up coming out was, would you be my sponsor? And those, I mean, it was like, I have no idea where those words came from. So she said, well, honey, she says, let's meet, and we'll see, you know, let's see if you're willing to do what I want you to do. And she laid out her requirements for sponsorship. She says, we will meet once a week. You will come to my home. She says, you will get yourself a big book. She says, not your husband's big book. You won't have him buy you one. She says, you'll get your own. You'll go buy your own. And she says, and we're going to read it together. She says, I don't want you reading it by yourself. She says, you don't know how. And she said, you're going to go to at least 2 meetings a week. And it's what I did, you know. And I said to her that day, I said, yeah, I can do that. And she says, no, she said, I want you to go home and pray about it. I want you to go home and think about it. And I said, but I'm sure. And she says, no, I want you to go home and think about it and go home and pray about it. Well, I was so sure of it that it took me 2 weeks to call her back. And, you know, we started doing this thing. And one of the first things I said to her was, you know, I said, I'm really concerned because this is my history with drugs and alcohol. And so I'm really wondering if Al-Anon's the program for me, or should I be in AA or NA? And she said, you know, she was a smart woman. She says, you're going to find your answer. She says, it's not for me to tell you. She says, you're going to find out. And she was right. As we started reading this book, you know, when we got to the parts about what was a real alcoholic and taking it or leaving it, I realized that I could take or leave alcohol. I could take or leave drugs. It's not a big deal. I could care less about them. What I couldn't take or leave was the alcoholic. That was what I was permanently attached to. He was my life, the way booze was his life. The alcoholic was everything I needed to be okay. I needed him to think I was okay, to be okay. So I got it. So we started working the steps, and my life started to change little by little. You know, I did the inventory. I read it to her. I got to the sixth step. I'm a little slow. After spending about a year on the sixth and seventh step, she said to me one day, I don't think I can help you anymore. She says, I don't know what to tell you to make you think that you're ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And so she suggested I go to a psychiatrist. And I did. And as I told him some of my story, some of my history, I started telling him about some, you know, sexual abuse I had as a child. And he said, honey, he says, stop right there. He says, I don't believe that we have to go back that far and you have to, like, talk about that to heal your present. He said, I think that what you do differently in today is what's going to heal what happened back there. And we started talking. Yes, I said to him, you know, my husband's doing this, my husband's doing that. We had about 4 or 5 years at this point. And I had a little, the reason I went to him was because I had this little problem with jealousy. I just couldn't quite overcome it, you know, and I didn't, wasn't entirely ready to let it go. And so as we sat there, he says, you know what your problem is? He says, you don't know if you want to stay or if you want to go. And I said, well, how long do I have to live like this? How long do I have to put up with it? And he says, well, I'll tell you something. He says, you put up with it longer than some. He said, you put up with it longer than most and not as long as some. And he says, I don't know. He says, I have no clue. He says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go home, and I want you to practice being the most loving, kind, considerate wife you can possibly be. I left his office so furious, I can't even tell you. I walked in my house. I didn't even put down my stuff. I called my sponsor and I said, do you know what that SOB said? And she said, no. And so I told her. And she says, yeah. And I said, well, can you believe he said that? And she says, honey, you're paying him $125 an hour. Why don't you try doing what he tells you? Now, this wasn't anything that she hadn't already been telling me. She had been telling me this for years. I just couldn't hear it until I paid for it. You know? It wasn't worth anything until I paid for it. So I started doing this thing, and I call it hit and run. You know, and I'd go and I'd touch him and I'd hug him and I'd leave real quickly, you know, and not even looking back because I was afraid he'd like give me a weird look or make some little sarcastic comment. And so I did this for a little while. I did it for a couple of weeks. And then one day I was passing by him in the kitchen. He was sitting at the dining room table and he said something or other, and he said, don't you think, dear, or something like that. And I thought, huh, imagine that. Imagine what being nice to somebody will do. But that wasn't even the blessing. The blessing was that I didn't need it to be okay. I had started to become a caring, loving person because it felt right. It felt like the right thing to do. Well, our lives started to change a little bit. I started to say, well, you know, I was wrong. And it was hard. But there's a difference between saying I was wrong and I'm sorry. You know, after a while, I'm sorry just doesn't cut it. I'm wrong has a real sense of I was wrong. What I did was not okay. Now, my sponsor ended up, about this time, she said, you're getting a little too dependent on me. I think you need to find somebody else. And I didn't know who in the world to get. I really had no clue. You know, I come from a small town, and we don't have, our Al-Anon members come and go. You guys have some people with long time, long years in the program. You are so lucky. You are so blessed. Please, I beg of you, don't take that for granted. Don't take it for granted. I've got just 15 years this summer, coming on July 2nd. I came into the program in 1986, and I have some of probably the longest time of anyone else where I live. And as far as I'm concerned, I am just a baby. I am just a baby. So people came and went, mostly they went. And when I said, there's nobody I can think of who has anything I want, there's nobody with much time, much less do they know anything about working the steps. And she said, well, maybe you ought to think about somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, who? Well, it turned out that my husband had a sponsor. She was a woman. And it's really funny because when he asked her to sponsor him, she said, well, you better ask Juanita. And so he did. And I said, well, I'm not crazy about it, but I'll think about it. And 2 days later, you know, he said, well, have you thought about it? And I said, yeah, I'm not crazy about it, but if you have to do it, go ahead. And so this same woman asked me to go with her to a conference up in Colorado, and I thought, oh, God, what has he told her about me, you know, blah, 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 the whole thing. But I ended up going, and I don't know if any of you have been there, but you start going on road trips with people in the program, and you're on your best behavior, right? It's like, you have no faults, right? I mean, it's like, God is the answer, you know? And it's like, yes, we can talk about the steps, and isn't life grand? And that was going. Coming down, I'm a blubbering idiot. You know, and she gets to see the real me. And what she says to me is, honey, you need to enlarge your concept of God. What are you talking about? I had no clue what she was talking about. And she says, you know, there comes a point when God's got to get bigger. God's brought you this far. Is this the same God? Is this God big enough to keep on taking you through this? And I said, I don't know. And she says, well, give it some thought. Well, the next day I was thinking about it and I thought, I think I need this woman for a sponsor. So I called her up and I said, do you think you'd sponsor me? And she said, well, I think you better ask Tom. The nerve. And so I did. And he said, I got to think about this. And so, you know, 2 days later, I say, well, have you thought about it? Now, this is how important it was to me. For the first time, I got a glimpse of what going to any lengths might be. Because I thought if he says, no, it's not okay, I thought, well, maybe we should separate. Because this woman and what she had was that important to me. And for the first time, I was willing to say, I'm willing to let my relationship go for some recovery. Well, when I went to him and I said, what do you think about this? And he said, well, I'm not crazy about it, but if you got to do it, okay. I said, okay. And I'll tell you what ended up happening. It wasn't even 4 days after I called her up and I said, Tom said, okay, that our youngest daughter, the Hours, I went home and I had a phone call. And the phone call was from her best friend's mother. And she said, I need to tell you that Nieves is okay, which immediately gets your panic button raised, you know. And she says, Nieves is okay. I said, what's wrong? And she says, well, she says, Nieves attempted suicide. 13 years old. She was 7 when we came into the program. This isn't supposed to happen. If this was going to happen, it was going to happen to the older kids because they lived with the craziness much longer than this one did. So I go to the hospital and she's laying there in the emergency room and I said, honey, I said, what happened? And she says, Mom, she says, I really didn't mean to do it. She says, but it hurt so bad. I said, did it hurt that much? And she says, it did. She says, it just hurt so bad in here. She says, it seemed like it was the only thing to do. So we ended up putting our daughter into an intensive psychiatric unit for adolescents. And within a couple of weeks, she was in there a couple of weeks, and towards the end, the whole family was in there one day, and the counselor turned to our daughter, and she asked her, well, do you think your parents love you? She paused. She had to think for a few seconds. And finally she said, now I do. Now I do. 5 years in the program, Tom and I had become friends. We'd become husband and wife. We'd become parents. We'd become lovers. But we were failing as parents. You know? We'd grabbed a hold of this program. We were becoming different people. But we were still not doing right by our daughter. So we had to do some serious looking at this. And it's actually the point of time when I think our family life started to change and our family started to heal. And I would love to say that it's all better and, you know, we're like walking into the sunshine, all our children and everybody. But that's not entirely true. There's still some things that have to be resolved. I really feel like my relationship with my two sons is really pretty good. I think some of it is that I'm just lucky at this point. I don't think they've necessarily had the ability to go back and really evaluate what happened as regards to me and them. But my oldest son will call me on Mother's Day and on my birthday. In fact, he's made dinner for me on my birthday. You know, so there's something going on there. He has 3 children. I was the one who got to be the first babysitter and give these little ones their first bottle. They trusted me enough to take care of their children. My youngest son lives in Chicago.
Oh, he used to live in Chicago. He lives in on Long Island right now. And when he got married about five years ago, we went to his wedding. And about 2 weeks before his wedding, he called up and he said, "We'd really like to have pictures for our wedding, but it's going to cost a lot of money. And what do you think?" And he says, "But the other thing is that if we take pictures, I don't want everyone in the picture. There's only certain people I want." And I said, "Well, sweetie," I said, "this is your wedding. And you can have your wedding exactly the way you want it. And whoever you want in your pictures, you can have in your pictures, because it's your deal." Well, he says, "We don't have much money for the pictures." And I said, "Well, let me talk to your dad." And so we talked, and you know, we gave him the money to get their pictures, their wedding pictures done. Well, when it came time to have the family pictures done, guess who wasn't in the pictures? Broke my heart. Broke my heart. I thought our relationship was better than that. You know, I had to leave the reception because I was in tears. I was in tears. And I thought, isn't this amazing? This is the very thing you did to them. And it is. You know, when Tom and I got together, the thing with alcoholism, the family disease of alcoholism, is that I could not be a stepmom to them. I separated myself from them. I would hear Tom drive up the driveway, and if there were two truck doors slamming, I knew he had them with him. And the anger would flare up. The anger I had towards Tom, I directed at those kids. I ignored them. It's amazing that we talk. It's amazing how far our relationship has come. There's still more healing to be done. My oldest daughter, the one who my mother raised when she was a teeny tiny little thing, is about to graduate from law school. Next week, in fact, next Saturday. She has two little ones. I got to be present at both these little ones' birth, which was an incredible deal. She sent me a letter not too long ago, and she says, "Mom," she says, "you're the kind of mother I want to be." Now, it's not the mother I was before coming to you. It's the mother that you all made me. It's the mother that working these steps, finding a God as a result of working these steps, that I became. My mother, when I was 43 years old, almost 5 years ago, for the very first time, as I walked into the kitchen, she was having a little birthday party for me. She invited the whole family. And I said, "Mom, thank you so much. This is such a nice thing for you to do. Thank you for the cake, and you know, thank you for doing this. It's so nice to have the whole family here." And she says, "Well, I love you so much." She says, "I'm so glad." She says, "I don't know what I would do without you." And she said, "And I'm so proud of you." It took 43 years for my mother to have a daughter that she could be proud of. You did this, you know? It took coming to you, working the steps, finding a God that could make me the daughter that a mother could be proud of. I had to make amends to her for the harm that my life had caused her. I was able also to thank her for being there for my daughter and taking care of her when I couldn't. My father, I'll tell you a little story about my father. You see, I told you about going to a Catholic girls' school. Well, I went to this Catholic girls' school, and who was in that girls' school with me were the daughters of doctors, lawyers, state governor. My dad was a janitor at the post office. I thought I deserved a different father than what I had. He should have been a doctor. He should have been a lawyer. He should have been far grander in his profession than the janitor. So when I got married the first time, my dad at the back of the church, when we were standing back there, he said to me, he said, "Honey," he said, "when we walk to the top of the aisle, before I turn you over to your husband," he said, "I want to hug you and I want to kiss you." And I said, "Okay, Dad." And I said, "Okay, Dad," without any intention whatsoever of allowing that to happen. So we get up there, and immediately I turn away from my dad and turn to this man who's about to be my husband. After the wedding ceremony, my dad comes up to me and he says, "You must be very ashamed of me." And I said, "No, Dad." I said, "Why? Why would you say that?" And he said, "Well, you didn't let me hug you and kiss you like I wanted to." And I said, "Oh, I forgot." I didn't forget. What a liar. You know, I hear alcoholics say they're liar, cheats, and thieves. Psh, you got nothing on me. You know, you got nothing on me. So I had to make amends to this dad. Now, I couldn't very well go up to him and say, "You were right, Dad. I was ashamed of you." You know, it would have broken his heart. So what I had to do was I had to start going into his home and finding him wherever he was and sitting down with him and letting him know that I really, truly cared about him. And so we'd sit and we'd chat and I'd say, "How was your day? What'd you do? Was it good?" And the hard part about this was that my mother was still angry at him. So it meant that I'd have to say hi to my mom, chat with her a little bit, and say, "I'm going to go find Dad and talk to him." And she'd get this look on her face like, "Oh, why would you bother?" You know? Because for me, Mom was always the one who had been wronged. My dad was wrong and my mom was right. So we started doing this and spending time with my dad. And one day, Tom and I were on our way to Colorado for a conference, and Dad came over just like he did Thursday or Wednesday, you know, and he said, "You guys be careful." He says, "When you're out there in Iowa," you know, back then he said, "when you go up to Colorado," he says, "you take care." And he gave me a hug and he said, "I love you so much." Same thing he said this week. He said, "I really, really love you." And I said, "I really love you, Daddy." And I kissed him and I hugged him. And our relationship has been repaired. It really has. You know, amends isn't about saying I'm sorry. Amends is about making something right. And you've helped me make my most important relationships right. My relationship with Tom is not at all the relationship it used to be. And it keeps changing, you know. It's, God, I never would have believed that I could love him. When he was in the treatment center, what I used to say in there when we'd have our family days, I used to say, "I love you, I love you, I love you." I didn't know if I loved him. I was trying to convince myself that I did, because I really didn't know. And it's so nice today to know I'm so proud of him, and that he's proud of me, and that I love him, and that he loves me. My youngest daughter, the one who attempted suicide, she's in Kentucky. She's in Bowling Green. She's going to school there. She's a junior. She's studying graphic design. And she's doing really well. You know, she's just become a member of Al-Anon. And she loves it. The thing with our kids, which I think you have given us, so often I hear people say, "You can't give this program to your kids." You can't, but you can. I have seen our kids change a bit. Not that their lives are perfect, and not that Tom's and my life are perfect, because they're not. They're far from it. You know, but it's a heck of a lot better than it used to be. And if I really take a look at it, it is perfect. It's only when my mind gets talking to itself that I make my own problems. I make my own problems. Life really is fine. I keep hearing over and over what was said to me before. The unmanageability centers in your mind. It's not in the outside world. And that really has become true for me. You know, and our children have healed a little bit. I got grandkids and they're the best things that you could lay eyes on. I could stand up here and brag to you forever, but I won't. My life is good. My life is about God. My life has purpose. There was a time when my purpose was about making him more miserable than I was. That's not the case today. I can be loving to him. I can be loving to my sponsees. I can be loving to people in our fellowship. I can be loving to people who aren't in our fellowship. You've given me that. You've taught me. And God has given me the power to do that. As long as I maintain myself in fit spiritual condition. There's a catch to this happy, joyous, and free thing, you know. It really is. It means I can't let up. You know, I can't sit on, what does it say, I can't rest on my laurels. The successes that I've had in this program, I can no longer just sit on them, because there's new ones. what I've seen for me, and it holds true more so today than ever before, is that as much as I've depended on God, as much as I've enlarged my conception of God, there's still more to take place. I have to depend on God in every aspect of my life, and there's still some areas where I know I haven't let Him in. God willing, with your help, with the help of the steps, with the help of my sponsor, and through God's grace, I'll continue to grow, and I'll continue to be of service. If you had told me 15 years ago that I was going to get to travel, that I was going to get to meet new people, that I was going to feel comfortable meeting new people, I'd have said, you're wrong. That could never happen. And it's really true. I'm really glad to be in Iowa. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to do anything that is for Al-Anon or that is for Alcoholics Anonymous. You all saved our life, and you've helped save our relationship, and you've helped save our family. I love you. God bless you.